Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Another day in a small town. Another day in a small town. Whoa, whoa. It's another day. Another day in a small town. Another day in a small town.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? From Northeast Arkansas, Brad Williams cut his teeth on bluegrass and gospel music. While fronting the local country band, the Salty Dogs, Brad finds time to play guitar with local roots rockers Big Silver. For Big Silver and Salty Dogs music, visit iTunes. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Christy Young. And our featured piece is this painting right over here, the small one, entitled Take Me Back, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Christy at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight's stories are, in various ways, about bridging gaps. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Julie Johnson Holt's gap appears to be a professional one, and we'll end the night with H.K. Stewart as he tries to bridge an all-too-familiar chasm. But let's start the night with Michael Collins as an incident brings together two worlds in The Magic Knife.
I'd gone with Pawpaw to buy his hunting license at Riley's Sporting Goods just off White Settlement Road when, much to my surprise, he asked Mr. Riley to flip open the knife case and see which one best fit my hand. As a son of an Arkansas mother and a Texas dad, hunting was in my blood. In fact, long before I could carry a rifle, I toted around the military stock of a 7mm Mauser that my grandfather brought home from World War II. What I wanted more than a rifle, however, was the kind of big hunting knife and leather scabbard that Johnny Weissmuller wore on his loincloth when he swung through the trees as Tarzan. Somehow, Pawpaw must have known. There on the green felt of Mr. Riley's case were countless knives. Some had handles made from antlers, some looked like daggers, and few had the telltale button of a switchblade. I liked them all, but very few had the type of guard Pawpaw insisted on. Sensing my dilemma, Mr. Riley reached behind his counter and pulled out the nice-looking knife that had a shiny chrome blade, a golden brown leather handle, and the perfect guard to keep my hand slipping from beyond the point of no return. "Michael, what do you think of this one?" I turned it over, switched it from my right hand to my left. It looked good and felt real, but the blade couldn't have been more than 3 inches long. "Is it big enough to skin a buck, Mr. Riley?" Once more, Mr. Riley reached beneath the counter and pulled out a box. "Look here, says Deerslayer, right on it. Even comes with a leather scabbard that fits on your belt." I needed no more convincing. Can I have it, Papa? Can I, please? Using the voice I'd only heard when he was buying a Chevy from Mr. Kennard downtown, Papa said, "How much you take for it, Mr. Riley?" Turning the box over, Mr. Riley glanced at the price. I got $375 on it, but I could go $3 since the boy likes it so much. Including tax, Mr. Riley? Sure, Charlie, including tax. On the ride home, I wanted to take the knife out, see the glint of sunlight shining on the steel, but for the same reason you didn't play with a loaded rifle, you certainly didn't travel up and down White Settlement Road, cross over to Lemon Street, then go up and down Burton Hill Road with a razor-sharp hunting knife sitting in your lap. Early the next morning, I was awakened from my bed to the sounds of Pawpaw's happy singing. "You'll be coming round the mountain when you come. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming round the mountain. She'll be coming round the mountain. Michael, we're leaving in about 20 minutes. Wash your face, get dressed. We'll eat donuts on the road." I struggled to get awake, but I was also excited. By tomorrow morning, I knew my knife might have helped me field dress a deer. At 2 p.m., we pulled at the last gravel road you took to get to Mr. Pinky's South Texas farm. When we arrived, we wasted no time headed for our stand, a 10-foot-tall mesquite tree that sported a rope ladder and a painted 4-foot-long piece of plywood that passed for a seat on the tree's largest branch. Once in position, I stared hard into the woods, seeking any sign of movement. Of course, with my young imagination, almost every windblown tree branch became a pair of world-class antlers. However, in less than 15 minutes, Papa put his hand on my leg, a sign that he had spotted something. I looked to my left just as he lined up his shot and pulled the trigger. "You got him," I exclaimed. "You got him with one shot." We approached the buck slowly, but once we were sure he was dead, Papa attached the block and tackle to a tree, hoisted the deer into position, then asked for my knife. He took it out of the scabbard and said, "Watch close. Something you need to learn." With that, he began the fine art of field dressing a deer, something I suspected Collins' men had been passing down for generations. Then after about a half hour, he handed back to me an awful example of what skinning a deer can do to a once pristine knife. "Probably need to wash that off," was all the advice he gave me. I hadn't seen a creek, but from our vantage point, I could see water in a large, round, galvanized cattle trough about 30 yards away. When I first walked up, I wasn't sure if I should stick my knife in the trough or work the pump until the water came out that kept the 100-gallon tub filled. Problem was, I couldn't find any handle to make the pump work. Therefore, I just plunged my knife into the cold water and swished the blade back and forth. Well, to my great surprise, however, the moment my knife went into the trough, water began to pour from the pipe. I then pulled my knife out, and water instantly stopped. I looked around, sure that somebody was playing a trick. I then plunged my knife back into the trough. Once again, water began to flow from the pipe. I pulled it out, and as if by magic, the water stopped flowing from the pipe. This time, determined to make a fool of whoever was trying to make a fool of me, I held the knife in such a way that no one playing a trick could tell that the blade wasn't actually in the water. I held it that way for a while, then dipped the blade in ever so slightly. A small trickle of water slowly flowed, but when I pulled it out, the water stopped. I paused for a second longer, then immersed the knife once more. Suddenly, water again poured from the pipe. I then pulled my knife out, wiped it on my camo pants, and the second I did, water instantly stopped flowing from the pipe. It was crazy. Was this some sort of sword in the stone thing? Some enchanted knife with unseen powers? If so, would I soon be visited by fedora-wearing bad guys like I'd seen in so many Superman movies? Michael, you finished? I turned to Pawpaw and said, I have a magic knife! A what? A magic knife. Each time I put the blade in the water, water pours out from the pipe, and when I pull it out, it stops. Watch! With great confidence, I plunged my knife into the water, and instantly, nothing happened. I pulled it out, and still, nothing. Then, as I turned to see his face, I heard water pouring from the pipe. And at that time, I also heard a squeak from the aged windmill that sat about 20 feet away. Figured it out yet? He said. Looking up at the windmill, I realized that each time the wind blew, the rotation of the fan blade powered the pump and pushed water through the pipe. In the case of my knife, even though it had happened over and over, there was no true cause and effect connection. It had all just been a perfectly timed coincidence. I sheathed my now clean knife and then turned and followed Pawpaw. My knife may not have been made for a sorcerer, but it was enchanted enough for me. And as the sun began to set, I knew that I had tasted the magical mystery of the unknown.
Raised in Fort Worth, Texas, Mike Collins' interest in the outdoors and storytelling was intensified by summers spent with his maternal grandparents in Crossett, Arkansas. He's also written two musicals, Glory Bound and Cruise Royale. Next, Julie Johnson Holt's assignment finds her straddling the line in Yes, Virginia.
According to my editor, Kelly Bass, at the venerable old gray lady in the late 80s, the Arkansas Gazette, Jennings Osborne had never graced a reporter with an interview about his elaborate display of glittery, glowing Christmas lights on Cantrell Road in Little Rock, the one that caused terrific traffic jams each evening during the holiday season. Kelly wanted me to give it a try. At the time, I was a features writer of the recently acquired Gannett paper, relishing my role of reporting on such heavy topics as the hottest Halloween costumes, high school slang, and the latest fundraising event involving Willie Oates and her hats. Jennings Osborne was already a larger-than-life character who did everything just the way he was, large. Though it was still a few years before he would bestow business suits to a certain former Republican governor or throw barbecue bashes before Razorback games. Nevertheless, I remember feeling quite nervous when I called the Osborne's number, expecting a quick and gruff refusal. My memory is a little fuzzy here, but I must have spoken with Mrs. Osborne, who was very nice and who agreed to let me come to the house for an interview. Feeling a little bit like I did as a girl on my first trip to the Garland County Fair, I couldn't help but delight in all the color and twinkles dancing around me that December evening as I drove through the wrought iron gate and parked on the wide drive leading to the stately home. Mitzi, Mrs. Osborne let me call her that, met me on the front lawn. Her little girl, Breezy, stood behind her for a short while, but soon became bored with the questions and answers and scampered off to enjoy her holiday playground. The lawn, Mitzi explained, featured 250,000 colored lights. That seemed like an enormous amount, but in actuality, was quite a minimalist display compared to the light shows the Osbournes would create in later years. It was the giant wall looming in front of the house that had served as the impetus for the holiday project. Mitzi told me the story. An intruder had attempted kidnapping Breezy, understandably upsetting and terrifying the family. Soon after, the Osbournes built the tall concrete barrier for security purposes. Neighbors, however, resented the wall and its keep out message, so the holiday lights were really a friendly gesture, I guess you could say an olive branch festooned with Christmas lights, extended to the neighborhood. The next day at work, I busily typed my story with some helpful guidance from my editor. By removing one word, Kelly changed the very hokey lead, "Yes, Virginia, there is a house under all those lights," to the very graceful one, "Yes, there is a house under all those lights." I, as we journalists say, put the story to bed and turn my attention to other assignments and to my own holiday chores. Several days later, I was returning from lunch break. I'd done some Christmas window shopping at Cones and Dillard's on Main Street and crossed the parking lot to the side door of the Gazette. A delivery truck stood in the alley near the entrance, and a man holding a very large tray struggled with the building's metal door. I ran to hold it open for him, holiday spirit and all, and I asked if I could help. He said yes, he needed to find J.J. Thompson. "That's me," I exclaimed. I couldn't imagine what he had on that large tray that could possibly be for me. But I led him up the worn marble stairs to the second floor landing with its impressive Regnus Populus fabric wall hanging and through the glass doors on the right marked Features Department. "What is it?" I asked as we climbed the stairs. "Shrimp," the delivery guy said, "from Jennings Osborne." This I remember vividly. I started sweating. Reporters weren't supposed to accept gifts valued over $25. That was a firm Gannett rule. And I'd already gotten in trouble for wearing fashionable walking shorts to work one day, and earlier on in my career for wearing a button that repeated Ann Richards' "Bye, George" phrase. I sure didn't need to be messing up again by receiving expensive gifts and looking like I could be bought. But wouldn't it be rude to say I couldn't accept the shrimp? Luckily, I had an editor, Kelly, who, along with being a good journalist, really liked good food. Kelly, along with my other colleagues, gathered around the department's freebie table, our favorite place because she could take home the latest novels that publishers had sent Bill Lewis to review, or cool kitchen gadgets mailed to our food editor. I still use an electric omelet pan I snagged off that table nearly 25 years ago. Anyway, while we were all trying to figure out how much a tray of boiled shrimp and crab legs was worth, my delivery man showed back up with another tray of shellfish. He must have made 10 to 15 treks up and down the stairs, with me growing more anxious with each one. You see, after he made his final exit, our freebie table and the nearest desk boasted 10 trays of shrimp and crab legs, 6 large green salads, and 10 key lime pies. No way that costs less than $25. Soon, managing editor David Petty found his way to the features department, where all work had pretty much stopped. I mean, really, it was quite the dilemma that needed a thorough discussing. Just the type of meaningful conversation that we serious folks in the features department like to have. And on that day, we had one, of course, about shrimp. Dismissing most of our suggestions, almost all of which concluded with us keeping the feast, perhaps sharing it with the newsroom folks, David put his foot down. We could have one tray of seafood and one pie. The rest would go to the Salvation Army. This was December 19th. Crisp blue sky, bright sunshine, cool but not cold. Kelly helped me load all the food onto the blue cloth back seat of my white Honda Civic, which I then drove the few blocks to the Salvation Army. The officers there were surprised, yet delighted, to receive the seafood and accompaniments. They told me they'd save it to serve at Christmas Eve dinner, which made me glad I wasn't working Christmas Day that year. As the big story could very well be about the hordes of food-poisoned homeless people wandering the streets of downtown. Back at the Gazette, I don't think I had the appetite to eat any of the shrimp or pie, though it disappeared quickly enough without me. I did, however, write a note to Jennings Osborne that I'm sure he was relieved to receive. Worrying about insulting him by not accepting his gift, I thanked him profusely, and I was sure to let him know that he was eligible for a tax write-off if he'd just contact the Salvation Army. I never heard back from him. Several years later, I moved with my husband and young daughter to Chapel Hill, where I pursued my master's degree in journalism. The holiday season arrived, but term projects and final exams naturally took precedence over festivities and lights. But another Christmas surprise caught me off guard. In my advanced reporting class, a classmate launched into a tale about a modern-day Santa from Little Rock and his huge, expensive holiday displays featuring millions of Christmas lights. The story, she said, was all over the national news. I know my eyes twinkled then. How fun to share that I was the first reporter ever to interview the Osbournes and to write about their Christmas lights. And at the risk of being hokey, yes, Virginia, that was worth a lot more than $25.
Julie Johnson Holt feels lucky to continue making a living largely playing with words, first as a journalist and now as a communications professional / business owner. Even better, she has a fabulous family and fantastic friends. In our final story of the night, H.K. Stewart tries to bridge the gap, but ends up teetering on the edge in Tech Support and the American Dream.
Can I talk to a real human being? Let me talk to a real human being. I know you've got to have some in there somewhere, and I just want to talk to one. Could you do that for me, please? Please let me talk to a real human being. I mean, you're nice and all, and I'm sure you got a great fake wife and terrific fake kids, but I'd really like to talk to a real human being. This is how I get through IVR hell now. I just start talking really fast. IVR stands for Interactive Voice Response, or something like that. That's where you call a big corporation and end up talking to a fake human being who asks lots of questions and gives you 6 or 8 choices, none of which has anything to do with your particular issue, and who makes you repeat your answers a lot. Back in September, my email, which had been humming along just fine for months, suddenly stopped working. I could receive emails, but I couldn't send them. I just kept getting a connection failed message. It gets even more insidious. This was true when I was at work, but when I took my laptop home and logged onto my network there, my email went through without a hitch. No error messages, no problem sending or receiving. At home, my email worked. At my office, my email didn't work. This after it had been working just fine for months. But I repeat myself. So I did what any self-respecting, computer-savvy male would do. I wasted 2 whole days trying to figure it out for myself. I am a guy, after all, and guys don't ask for directions. That didn't work, so I finally got on the phone and into IVR hell. I talked fast and didn't give him a chance to argue. Fake man finally gave up trying to understand me and sent me to a telephone holding pen of some sort with recorded music. It was like being on a really long elevator ride. From there, I eventually ended up talking to 2 different human beings, real ones, at my internet service provider. That would be my ISP. I won't say which company that is, but its initials are AT&T. At any rate, after a lot of heroic effort on the part of the second gentleman, we were able to get the problem solved. I could finally send emails from my office again. Hallelujah, praise the Lord, amen! Until the following Tuesday. On Tuesday, it started doing the same thing all over again. I won't bore you with the minutiae of what I went through the second time around, but I finally ended up late on Thursday, back on the phone with that ISP place I mentioned earlier. After talking my way around the fake human again, I ended up with a different guy who had to listen to my long, sad tale. We worked our way through his list of solutions with no success. He finally gave up and gave me the number of the technical support desk at the company who actually handles my email on behalf of my ISP. This company, too, shall remain nameless, but its initials are Yahoo. When I called the number, I got another fake human, a fake woman this time, who gave me four options. The one I picked sent me back to my ISP and the same fake man I'd had to maneuver around 45 minutes earlier to get the real human who couldn't help me. But I stayed on the line anyway and ended up talking to a different human, a woman this time. I started the conversation by telling her she probably wasn't going to be able to help me. But I went ahead and laid out my case one more time anyway. I think she must have taken it as a personal challenge when I told her she wasn't going to be able to help because she spent the next hour going through everything she could think of to tell me to try. But nothing worked. It was all stuff I already tried with the others. By the end of the hour, the day had turned into evening, and she was frustrated, and I was frustrated. We got to the point where we were both talking over each other, our voices getting louder and louder. Finally, I said, "Can you just forward me to someone else? Kick me upstairs to another tech support person, maybe? Your supervisor, maybe?" She didn't say anything for a few seconds, then answered, "Sure." She sent me back to the telephone holding pen. Then about a minute later, the fake guy came back on, and I realized she had just sent me right back to where I'd started 2 hours earlier. It was like being in a Kafka novel. I hung up and called Yahoo again, but this time I picked a different option, which took me to a recording that said they don't offer technical support over the phone for that particular issue. That's when I gave up. I packed up my laptop and left the office a beaten man. When I got home, I told my wife what I'd been through. Then I went outside and sat on the patio in the backyard, tried to shake off the misery and frustrations of the day. I leaned back in my chair and looked up at the dark sky and thought about the woman on the other end of the phone and how we'd both ended up talking over each other. It made me feel bad about letting myself get to that point with her, because I know that's got to be a lousy job a lot of the time. You're either a savior or the Antichrist. If you can help a poor, technologically ravaged soul, you're a hero. If not, you become the devil's spawn. Some tech support people actually are the devil's spawn, of course, but she wasn't one of them. I think she really did want to help me solve my problem in the beginning. But by the end, it just wasn't within her power to fix. She ran out of answers, and we both ran out of patience. As I sat there looking up at the black silhouettes of oak trees against the night sky, it occurred to me that this is where we are as a nation, too. We're dealing with problems that don't have easy answers, and we're frustrated. We've ended up talking over each other and raising our voices and ignoring each other to the point we're losing our ability to govern ourselves. Maybe what we're dealing with is as much a spiritual problem as anything else. I don't mean that if we just all head off to church on Sunday mornings, everything would be okay. I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about that innate awareness each of us has somewhere deep inside, that we're all connected. We're a communal species. We need each other. In our best moments, we want to help one another, just as my AT&T friend wanted to help me. This is one of the reasons America's in such pain these days. We're losing our ability to see our connectedness, but it's still there. And a little email trouble, that's a small price to pay to learn that all over again.
H.K. Stewart is a native of Little Rock, Arkansas, where he's worked as a freelance writer and graphic designer since 1988. He is also the author of the book, Gift, Meditations from a Spiritual Journey. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight?
Thank you.
Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
Shining bright, doing 30 in a 60. Well, it ain't right, and I tell you something, you don't know who you're dealing with. Well, from San Francisco to San Bernardino, San Fe, Nashville, to Reno, four tons of steel, son, you better recognize. And I'm pegging them up and I'm laying them down, and I'm driving this rig town to town. You oversized load, you're never gonna slow.